The John Rappaport Show, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
From too much talk to silence. We turned our hearts to love and tried it. First time a man. There in the twilight, love learns to dance.
Welcome, everybody. This is John Rappaport, and this is the John Rappaport Show that airs every week on PRN at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. We have a guest today. We'll get to that in a second. But just wanted to let you know that we are talking about finances, financial meltdown, economic devastation on a wide scale in this broadcast, and these are very serious matters. I don't think I need to actually say that, but I will anyway, because the question is, what caused this to happen? What is the situation that we face, and what are the possible answers? So for this, we bring in for a second interview Catherine Austin Fitz. Her website is www.solari.com. She has had a full and varied career in the world of finance. At one time, the Assistant Secretary of Housing, Federal Housing Commissioner under Bush 1. Previous to that, Managing Director and member of the board of the Wall Street firm Dillon Reed. She's closed more than $25 billion of transactions and investments in her career. Catherine, welcome back.
John, it's always a pleasure.
Great to have you. I want to jump right into this, and so I've concocted a hypothetical to begin. Let's suppose that in one of these multifarious congressional hearings on the financial collapse, there were witnesses, there were people testifying, and so on and so forth. And then after it was all over, some senator or congressman, a person you knew, and to make it really hypothetical, trusted, brought you, who were not a witness, into his office, closed the door, and then said, okay, Catherine, please, give me the real story. How did this happen? Why did this happen? What would you say?
Well, what I would say is a group of people decided to shift significant amounts of money out of the United States. Much of it was done covertly. It's what I call a financial coup d'etat. So I don't think we've had a collapse. I think we've had a financial coup. And that was all part of a process over the last 50 years that has centralized tremendous control of the economy and the political system, and facilitated, of course, by very powerful new technology. And in the process of that, we've watched, the more we centralize, the more we pull the innovation and creativity out of the broader system, and so the more fragile the system comes. And what we're watching right now, John, is the end game, which is you pull all the capital out of the country and you engineer that shift by bubbling the economy and the planet with enormous amounts of debt that sovereign governments and consumers can't afford. you know, and then there's an end game, and the end game is like a game of a musical chairs, which is, you know, who gets their chair pulled and who gets to keep their chair. And you've got to pull, you know, you've got to pull 100 chairs for every one that somebody gets to keep. So we're into the end game right now, and that's what the story is. We've had a financial coup d'etat, and now the question is, you know, who's going to get left holding the bag, and how are we going to sort it all out?
Okay. Now, how do we understand, let's say over here we have all of the voluminous correspondence, articles, books, etc., about the mortgage-derived instruments, investments, and how they were horrible and they collapsed, etc., 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 and that this was a precipitating factor in the collapse, that AIG had to be saved, and then we have Goldman Sachs, etc., etc., and all of this kind of sometimes what sounds fairly specific, sometimes very hazy information. And then what you just said, which is all of this capital covertly being transferred out of the country. Are these two things connected? Is one the cover story for the other? What's the story there?
Well, the one is a cover story, or one is a yarn, okay? When you have a financial coup d'etat, you take over, a coup d'etat is when you have a change of power. And a financial coup d'etat is when you simply use financial means to do it. And so when you have a financial coup d'etat, you hear a variety of excuses. Oh, this was really complicated, or, oh, we're incompetent, or we didn't realize it sort of got out of hand. And those are various yarns that are spun to explain why trillions of dollars is disappearing. You know, because you don't want to say, look, we stole trillions of dollars, because then you create a pathway to get it back. Because, you know, if you steal my money, I can always, you know, come and steal it back from you, right?
Right. Yeah.
So you don't want to, you don't want people to take away the conclusion, oh, there was a financial coup d'etat. Because what that means is the system isn't legitimate, and by the way, the money's someplace and you can go get it back. Okay,
right.
So you want to give people a framework for what happened that gets them, you know, to go along with the money staying wherever it's gone to, okay, or keeps that in the dark. And so you come up with these various excuses. So it was complicated, or the guys at Goldman are greedy, or, you know, but those are all various governments not competent, or we didn't have the right regulation, because, of course, you want a solution that fits with your keeping the money. So you want to say, oh, well, the problem was we didn't have the right regulation. So then you pass a financial reform bill that gives you more power and more central control. You know, so it allows you to harvest it some more. So,
right.
So you know, we had a financial coup d'etat, a variety of these things, and we can explain them in deeper, you know, we can explain them one by one. But they're basically yarns and spins that tries to explain what happened in a way that leads you to be able to keep the money that's been stolen and not illuminate how the system is really working.
Okay. So now let's take this. We have people losing their homes. They can't make the mortgage payments. The banks are foreclosing, et cetera, this and that. And this is tied to the whole idea that these mortgages that were folded into these derivatives that were being traded massively, they failed. So what I'm inferring from this and from what you're saying is that to some degree the cover story is a true fact, but it doesn't explain what actually happened, which is, as you say, the theft of gigantic amounts of money. So would that be correct to say?
Yeah, so let me break that down in a couple of ways. In the early 90s, I was I had been Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration, and then I left and started my own company, which was later hired back on competitive contract to serve as the lead financial advisor of the Federal Housing Administration. And in the early 90s, during that period, one of our great concerns as a policy question was, if we pass the GATT, the Uruguay round of GATT, and we pass NAFTA, all the jobs are going to leave America. You remember Ross Perot during the 92 debate saying the giant sucking sound?
Yeah.
Well, what that meant was the income of the middle class was going to get wiped out because all of the middle class jobs were going to go abroad. Okay, so we knew the middle class was going to have its income dropping dramatically in real dollar purchasing power terms because that's what these policies were destined to do. So concern number one is how do we help the middle class transition the process of globalization if we pass the GATT round and create the WTO and implement NAFTA? So that was concern number one. Concern number two was as people age in America, particularly as their incomes are falling, how do we make sure that their retirement savings is sufficient? So how do we make sure we get the proper yield on investments in pension funds? And both of these conversations, John, were very much on everyone's mind in America. And I was part of a team of people in Washington who were putting forward plans as to how we could invest our pension funds and retirement savings so that the middle class would have a proper retirement when the time that we're in now came, and then how the middle class could adjust and how we could keep incomes up. And if you read my story, the Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, I describe a lot of my proposals. It's the Solari model to help achieve those two ends. Now, a decision was made that my proposals were very firmly rejected, as we all know. And instead, a decision was made, look, let's simply, the theory was you can't trust Americans to kind of face the music and go about this in a responsible way. So what we're going to do is we're going to do the irresponsible plan. We're going to encourage people, rather than getting the middle class to pay down its debt because they literally couldn't afford it, we're going to encourage them to take on dramatic new mortgage and consumer debt. We're going to encourage state and local government and the federal government to take on massive amounts of more debt. And that debt will create a debt bubble, of which the housing bubble was a very important part. And in the process, we'll move enormous amounts of capital out of the country. And then, literally, once we've got the money out, we'll just let it collapse. And that's exactly what happened. I call it fraudulent inducement. But it was absolutely engineered, and in the process, a great many mortgages were originated when it was completely clear at the top that these mortgages could never be paid off. Therefore, the mortgage securities that were used to pull those mortgages could never be paid off, and the derivatives layered on top of it could never be paid off. So this was all known at the time. And the full chain from the origination of the mortgage to the wrapping of the mortgage-backed security and the derivatives and the sale of it was, if you look at the letter of the law, was rife with violations of the both civil and criminal of the securities laws of this country and of the financial fraud laws, including, I've always expressed serious question under the laws of related to fraudulent inducement. As far as I'm concerned, with the exception of a few people, the vast majority of mortgages originated in this country after 1996, in my opinion, were fraudulently induced. And it's not clear to me that under the law they're really that the homeowners really owe that money back to the banks.
Because they were tricked into paying it.
Well, here's how fraudulent inducement works. If I know that your income is going to fall and you don't, and I encourage you to take on debt you think you can afford, but given what I know you can't afford, and I don't disclose that to you, that is a material omission, and that loan has been fraudulently induced. And, you know, just from my experience, it's clear to me that there's a wonderful video up on my blog. If you come to my blog, it's larry.com/blog, and you do a search for Sir James Goldsmith, it's one of the most prescient videos and one of the most important videos you could ever watch, John, to understand the economy in 2010. And it's an interview of Sir James Goldsmith, very successful, you know, at the time a billionaire, businessman who put his career on hold to literally dedicate his life to trying to stop Europe and the United States from adopting the Uruguay Round of GATT, instituting the World Trade Organization, and basically launching an unprecedented centralization of the global economy in a manner that would lead to massive unemployment globally and tremendous movement of small farmers off the land. The dislocation here in the United States and Europe, as terrible as it is nowhere near as terrible as what is being done to the small farmer globally, which is, in essence, and Goldsmith describes it as such, as literally genocide. And, and he gave this interview in 1994 with Charlie Rose of Bloomberg, and he lays out exactly what's going to happen economically with this kind of centralization and the devastation it will wreak, including the devastation to the middle class in America. And what is happening today is exactly that. I'm going to be putting up a wonderful chart up on my blog that shows in the previous recessions in the United States how employment has come back and what's happening on this one. And, in fact, we're coming into extraordinary unemployment. If you look at the figures on people who've been unemployed for more than 27 weeks, it's very high and rising.
This is John Rappaport. I'm talking with Catherine Austin Fitz. Her website is www.solari.com. Well, okay. Now, you talked about these discussions at the top and how the scheme was that huge amounts of money were going to go out of the country, and that there was going to be a virtual collapse of the middle class. Now, in these discussions, I can't imagine that people were actually talking about this as we're going to steal this money. They were talking about currents of money that would leave the United States because of the GATT Treaty and NAFTA. Is that the way it was kind of being framed at the time?
Well, let me give you an example, because I only know the conversations I was privy to, but from watching the movements of money, I can imagine some that went on. In the spring of 1997, I had a meeting with a wonderful group of pension fund leaders, including the president of CalPERS, the largest pension fund in the country, the California Public Employees Pension Fund. They now have over $200 billion that they're managing. And I presented our analysis of government investment in the Philadelphia area and then how it could be reengineered in a way that would really help create a whole new kind of employment and particularly supportive of small business and dramatically improve performance on government money and how this could help create an enormous opportunity for the pension funds. And essentially, the pension funds could make an awful lot of money on reengineering government investment in this country in a way that would really build up employment and income and jobs. And so I presented this all. It was a great presentation, and the president of CalPERS was very touched, and he said, this is wonderful. He said, but I don't understand. You know, this is what we tried to do. He used to work for Saul Alinsky in community organizing, and, you know, the powers that be would not let it happen. And, of course, he was right, and I was being naive, and I said, well, the technology allows you to dramatically increase learning speed, you know, in and between small businesses and in a municipality in ways that can get just unbelievable improvement in productivity, both in terms of traditional government expenditures as well as small business and equity investment in places. And so it's really the new technology that allows this kind of unleashing. And he stopped. He froze, John. It was really one of the most, you know, you have these moments in life when suddenly something happens which is so earth-shattering. Everything slows down and you just, you know, you feel the earth move. And he stopped, and it was one of those moments. And he looked at me, and he literally almost had tears in his eyes. Only time I saw a pension fund leader have tears in his eyes. He said, "You don't understand. It's too late." He said, "They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall." He said, "You've got to get to Nick," meaning Nick Brady, who'd been the Secretary of Treasury and the chairman of the firm I work for on Wall Street. He said, "You've got to get to Nick. You've got to tell him that it's not hopeless." And that fall, John, was October 1997, which is when money, vast amounts of money, started to disappear from the federal government. We know between that fall and 2002, over $4 trillion that we know of is missing from federal accounts, and I suspect it's a lot more. And you can steal that much from the federal government if you engage in securities fraud. And for reasons I've described in many of my articles, you know, I believe the securities fraud has been quite significant. And that's what's part of making this financial meltdown so difficult. It's the fraud has gotten, you know, too complicated and too much to be able to handle easily. But I say that because when you say, you know, they pulled a lot of capital out of the country, that was $4 trillion that was covertly pulled out. Now, from my point of view, what I assume happened was, you know, when you were at the level of being able to order the largest pension fund in the country to move money out of the country, and, you know, given that you're moving money out of the country, finance the housing bubble, because the scary thing about all of that is then CalPERS knows, as it's buying all this mortgage paper, that paper is, you know, is you're buying mortgage paper that is secured by all these homeowners who don't know but are going to have income falling. You know that's a bad bet. So we now see a shadow government that has the power to order, you know, the largest pension fund in the world to reposition its money in ways which are above the law, if you will. You know, and so that means when they have conversations, they don't think of this as criminal or illegal, because the system that they think they're managing is very different than the official reality. In other words, they're functioning, the way they function is above the matrix, and they're dealing with reality. And then everybody in America is in the matrix, and there's an official reality, an official spin. And they don't think of things within the criminal versus not criminal lines that the average American might think of. They're operating at a meta level, and they don't think of things that way. But if somebody, you know, if what that pension fund leader said to me is true, and I believe it is, then you know, there was a decision to move massive amounts of money out, both covertly and overtly, and of course, both happened. We saw institutions move tremendous amounts of capital into the emerging markets, and that's the right thing to do, because we know, it, you know, growing, young and growing populations have more equity growth than aging populations. Now, you know, that's one thing. The overt thing was to basically take the retirement savings, whether inside of state and local and federal government or households, and basically engineer it out in a way that before it left, we owned it, and by the time it got to Asia, you know, they owned it. And so that was covert and criminal. Now, another thing has been going on, because this is not just the United States. It would be a mistake for us to sit here and talk as if, oh, poor us. What we watched was a process of harvesting places, not just the United States, but Russia, Eastern Europe, Latin America, with the WTO and the new global rules, where we're literally watching centralization of wealth globally and in ways that are much more, if we think the economic warfare that we're experiencing here and have experienced, it's nothing compared to what happened in Russia or Latin America, where literally people go to bed one night and they have money in a pension fund and they have money in banks and they have currency in their wallet and they wake up in the morning and the pension fund is gone. The banks won't let you get the money out and the currency is falling to nothing, so by the time you can get it out, it's worthless. And the money they have in their wallet is worthless. And suddenly, you know, what they've discovered is the hedge funds are coming in and buying up all the companies and land in their country for, you know, pennies on the dollar. So you know, the ugliness of what we're watching has been going on on an accelerated basis since the early 90s worldwide.
Okay. So let me ask what may be an oversimplified question, but it refers back to where you started. Where is the money? Let's say it's trillions, we don't know how many, 10, 20, 30, whatever it is, or more. And you said if you knew that somebody had stolen the money from you, and you knew it was stolen, and you knew who stole it, then you might have a chance of figuring out where it went and getting it back. So in this case, with all of the complication, where did all that money go?
Okay, so here's my guess. I think some of that money went into the emerging markets for reinvestment. You know, so and part of the problem was it leaves here and it's owned by these 100 shareholders and it shows up there and it's owned by a different group of people. So it's kind of a theft in the process of shift. But I think it's reinvested in the emerging markets is one place it is. I think there's been a huge investment in space and black budget weaponry. And then I think some has been spent to keep the wheels of a variety of different bureaucracies going, and some has just been wasted or, you know, put in people's offshore accounts. So it's a combination of places. And the most important thing we need to know to get back the money is we need to decide who's in control. And one of the reasons you want to make an effort to get the money back is because you want to assert control by some kind of intelligent and lawful governance as opposed to what we have now. So step number one is you want to bring transparency, and then number two, you want to assert control. You want to assert control of both the governance process and who controls those assets and money now. Now, someone will say to me, well, you know, the money left in 2000, you know, the money was stolen out of HUD or and laundered through Enron in 2000, and it's long gone into offshore accounts. And what I have to say is, no, that's not exactly the case. And here's why. If a dollar gets stolen, John, you don't have to get that dollar back. You just have to assert that that dollar was stolen, and then you have to define the responsible party, and then you assert what's called a common law right of offset. So let me give you an example. $4 trillion is missing from the federal government. Well, $4 trillion can't go missing unless it leaves through the banks, okay, whether it's through a bank account or it's through the securities arrangements. And the securities arrangements are also at the banks that serve as depositories of the U.S. government. Okay, so if that $4 trillion left, it left through the banks as depositories or servicers acting without having a proper authorization. We know the Constitution requires, you know, appropriation before something can be shifted through a bank account.
Hold that thought, because we had a take break at the bottom of the hour here. This is John Rappaport. I'm interviewing Catherine Austin Fitz, www.rappaport.com. Solari, SOLARI.com. This is PRN. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
From too much talk to silent touches, sweet touches.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hello, I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
This is an emergency. No, it isn't. It's an urgency. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com with a new show called News Dissector. It's built on the blog that I do every day from MediaChannel.org, dissecting news, analyzing what's happening in the world, offering very cool music and great guests. Thursdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Be there for B-Square.
Hi, I'm Richard Martin of The Wake Up Call. We have a new Sunday evening show called Richard Martin's Discussion Group, which airs at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can access it live on www.progressiveradionetwork.com, or you can listen to it on the archives. This is your show and your opportunity to air your thoughts, questions, and rants on the ills of today's economy. There'll be a theme each week, and I want to hear from you. So please, come on in. Sundays, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and tune in to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.com. You have a date with us. See you then.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz. Every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
John Rappaport here, talking with Catherine Austin Fitness. I want to pick up from where you left off. I think you were about to say...
Okay, so you're talking about... Here are different ways you get the money back.
Yeah, in other words, it's trackable. If
right,
the money leaves the country, it's got to leave it in certain ways, and there are ways to find out how it's leaving and how much of it is leaving.
Right, and if let's say the banks say, well, we can't know that because we destroyed the records, or Luxembourg won't let you see that information. You don't. All you have to do is ascertain that one party was liable in the leaving, and that party is liable for the money. You know, they may not have it anymore, but they're liable for it. So, for example, the $4 trillion missing from the federal government breaks down to about $14,000 per person. So let's just imagine tomorrow, and I'm talking theoretically, but these can all be brought to ground if enough people are willing to come together. If everybody who owed one of the banks that is a member and therefore shareholder of the New York Fed, which serves as the depository for the U.S. government, so everybody who owed more than, you know, $14,000 to Chase or Bank of New York or Goldman Sachs or Citibank said, you know something, I'm asserting a common law right of offset. And you know, I owe you $14,000, but it turns out you owe me $14,000 because $14,000 is missing from my government. So, you know something, I'm asserting common law right of offset. I don't owe you that $14,000. You owe me $14,000, and so the two offset. I'm keeping my $14,000. Okay, we just got, if enough people did that, we'd get our $4 trillion back. Now, of course, Chase would say, hey, you know, we don't have that paper anymore. We sold it to your pension fund. So it would get more complicated than that, but that's an example of a common law right of offset. And, in fact, it's one I've exercised. Because, in fact, I did stiff one of the New York Fed banks for $14,000, and that's the reason why. Okay, tax escrow. If you look at all the taxpayers in a county, let's say we have a county of 100,000 taxpayers, and let's say, well, you know, I don't want to stiff Chase on my auto loan for $14,000. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to get together with my county officials and all the other taxpayers, and what I'm going to say is, you know, U.S. government, you are not being operated according to the law. You're violating the Constitution. You're violating the Financial Management Act. You're violating the regulations. And so your finances are not run according to the law. Therefore, what we do is we're going to assert the right to escrow the money here. So we all owe you, let's say in my county, it would be on average $5,000 a year. So we owe you $5 million. We're going to put that in an escrow. And we're going to use that escrow to pay the expenses locally that normally the federal government pays, except we're going to do it more flexibly. We're going to do it our way. And, you know, something, you just keep your money. And here's, out of that $5 million, we're going to write you a check for $1 million for the debt, the Treasury debt. So here's your $1 million for the debt. And meantime, you know, we are, until you clean up your act, we are asserting responsibility to make sure the money is spent according to the Constitution and the laws related to the financial management of federal taxes. Okay, what does that do? That gives you control. It also gives you massive amounts of flexibility and power in making sure that money gets spent in much more efficient ways with a lot less corruption. Now, somebody would say, oh, that can't happen. The reality is, if the federal government is conducting its operations in a criminal way, you know, under the law, I believe there is a way for that to happen, and it would have to be battled out in the courts. So let me give you a third example, John. We know that there is an over $2 trillion economy at risk along the coastal southeast of America from the Gulf oil spill. Okay?
Yeah.
And we know the federal government and is not acting. There are many things that could be done. The federal government is not moving to do it. So why not have the states basically assert, you know, the federal government is out of compliance with the laws related to protecting our environment and protecting our human health and environmental health. We're going to get together as a group, issue something called the Gulf currency, and use that currency to pay farmers and fishermen and a whole variety of people to lead a much more decentralized organic cleanup. And, you know, think of this as sort of a environmental Dunkirk campaign. Mm-hmm. You know how Churchill said to all the fishermen, go out and get the troops and bring them back. And they did. Well, you know, we have that kind of emergency situation. Now, under the Constitution, it's the federal government that issues the currency. I would say in this circumstance there are emergency ways of issuing a script that could be considered tender for certain purposes by those state governors if they got together.
No question now, about it. In fact, I've looked at that before. There's a currency called Ithaca Hours that an old acquaintance of mine started in Ithaca, New York, and they queried the federal government about it. And the consideration was basically, back from the Treasury Department, there's nothing illegal about what you're doing, as long as people pay taxes on it in equivalent amounts. So the idea of local currencies that are not federal can fly, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. So, but the reality is we're going to have to get radical, because when you have the central bank and the federal government operating on a criminal basis in a manner which is designed to shut down your economy, you cannot afford to remain dependent on them. So everyone is sitting frozen in the states and counties trying to figure out a way to please the federal government on the theory that they don't want to jeopardize the money they're getting. Well, that's ridiculous. If you look at the cash flows in any county, whether it's us as a taxpayer sending our money to Washington or us as an investor sending our money to Wall Street, we're sending our money into the system. We're financing it. And so the question is, when are we going to get the gumption to say, you know something? We are going to, you know, you are not conducting yourself in a lawful manner. So you are operating outside the laws of the Constitution and legislation related to a variety of different financial issues. You know, and that's true for whether it's Washington or Wall Street. We're going to start asserting under the 10th Amendment the things we need to do to make sure that we are literally not depopulated. Because what is happening in America is we are being demodernized and we are being depopulated, and it is going to continue until we change it. And part of changing it is shifting the money, but shifting the money in a way which is truly lawful. Because what is missing from this situation is adult management. I mean, the problem, you know, we're now entering a new phase of the situation, and the reality is, you know, that what you're watching is a game of economic warfare, which has become so dysfunctional and so damaging to the real economy, you're looking at a government and a financial process which is not, you're looking at a financial system, John, that is not under adult supervision.
I understand. I want to shift here to a related issue, and that is, because I'm still stuck a little bit on previous question and answer, and that is this. Let's say that the bulk of this stolen trillions, you talked about investing it covertly in space weapons, black budget operations, and emerging markets in other parts of the world, which means that it's transferred to other owners and so on. So then I have to ask this. The people who did this, who are doing it, who know that they're doing it and know that what the effects of it are going to be, in this case, on the people of the United States, what is going through their minds? It's like saying, we have these needs, and part of the need is that we want to steal this money, or we want to take it and use it for certain purposes.
They don't think of it as stealing it.
Or overriding, but at the same time, we don't care what happens to the country or the people. So, to me, that signals that there's yet another motive going on here, which is we, in fact, want to diminish the country. Our intention is to diminish the people of the United States, to bring it down to the level of other nations economically, that we have this motive, we're doing it on purpose, and we have a reason for doing it. So
right.
I would say it this way.
They would say, we don't think that the sovereign government model works. We basically want to shift the assets out of control of both households / communities and governments and centralize it into a relatively small group of corporations. So we want to run the planet. You know, at the very top, we have a small intergenerational pools of capital, which are invisible. And then we run it through a bureaucracy of sort of G20 and large corporations, insurance companies, banks, investment groups, okay? And sovereign governments will become weaker and weaker and have less control of assets or ownership of assets. And, you know, so this 20-year process has been shifting the assets into corporations and highly centralized. And in that process, we're going to rebalance the economy. So the first world is going to drop in income and assets in terms of broad-based, and the emerging markets, the second, third worlds, are going to rise. And in that process, we're going to control agriculture and bring about a very, you know, we've controlled before through oil. Now we're going to control through food, mm-hmm. by controlling the seed supply and the production and distribution of food. And in that process, we're going to end up getting a very significant level of depopulation. So after we emerge into this sort of highly controlled corporate governance structure, we're going to have a more rebalanced global economy, but we're going to have a much smaller population.
Okay, so then now we're talking about the actual motives at the top.
Here's the thing. I don't think we know the motive, but let me speculate as to some of what we can see. We've had on planet Earth an investment model called central banking warfare, and that model can't last. You need to change. So you can either go to something much more decentralized and open, or you can go to something even more closed, and they appear to be going to something more closed.
Mm-hmm.
And technology will allow you to do that. Part of the problem, if you're at the top, is how do I keep harvesting this place? How do I keep controlling this place if this powerful new technology becomes universally available? So, for example, we know that, you know, very powerful alternative and free energy technology exists. How do you let that become available and unsuppressed and still maintain control? Because remember, you've controlled by being the reserve currency, and you could be that because you controlled oil. So again, you know, how do you do that? If you want a one-world digital currency, how do you do that and unsuppress energy technology? Well, you get control of the seed supply, you control food. You know, so you have these control issues, because remember, what these folks most care about is control, and they're grappling with unsuppressing lots of, you know, they're grappling with you know, new technology and the social impact of that technology, which is incredible. So that's number one. Number two, what we don't know is who really is they. You know, do UFOs come from another planet, or do they come from planet Earth? You know, we know we have aliens, we just don't know where they come from. You know, or whether we've just become as aliens to each other. And then finally, you know, there are questions about what are the geophysical risks that they perceive, and what's that about? And I don't think we know the, because one possible explanation for their behavior is they're very concerned about a variety of different geophysical risks over the next 100 years, and that explains their desire for very tight control. Remember, the people at the top, in my experience, are very, very afraid of the broad population. They're very, very afraid of an open market. You know, democracy and open markets truly is something that terrifies them, because they assume that the common person will not behave responsibly.
So they can behave responsibly.
On behalf of everybody else,
which means control.
Well, but I've lived at almost every level of society, from the top to the bottom, you know, and I would say that I did not find any greater, you know, there was not a whole lot of different in ethics at the bottom than that there is at the top.
Yeah, there are some insane people and there's some sane people.
Right, and so, you know, that's why transparency is so important, because, you know, transparency allows us to look at the ridiculousness of our own behavior. And where transparency applies to everybody, you know, the natural intelligence can kick in and we can make each other more intelligent. Because clearly that's not happening here. But my assumption is that there are geophysical risks that they're concerned with. At a minimum, how does the planet support the population, and how do you maintain a a population which is in harmony with the ecosystem on Earth.
Well, from their point of view, what they're looking at is studies that have been done which they think suggest that you have to shrink the population of the planet way down in order to have some kind of ecological balance. But at the same time, you and I both know that at the elite levels of environmentalism, for example, you've got people running around who really do believe that essentially human beings themselves are hardwired to be a monumental threat to life on this planet, and therefore they have to be either eliminated or controlled in a very, very tight way. And that so under the cover of saying Gaia and we all love the planet and so on, where the real money is coming from, these are people who have an enormous distance from the population, and as you say, have a tremendous paranoia and suspicion about people in general. So for them, it would be ideal to see the world in some sort of pastoral fantasy where, you know, the technology is there, but yet at the same time, there's a very small population, very easily
controlled,
et cetera, et cetera.
I have far more empathy for the guys at the top than you do.
Really? I don't know. It doesn't sound like it.
Despite the pain that I've experienced trying to deal with them. But here's why. If you look at the history of the last 500 years, the crowd always supports the criminal. You know, I'll use the story of the crucifixion. The Romans know it's bad karma to kill Jesus. Pontius Pilate's trying to get out of it. He's trying to come up with any way to wiggle out, you know, because the priests want him to, but he knows it's bad politics. He doesn't want to do it. So he turns to the crowd and he says, look, I'll give you a choice. You can crucify, you know, what's his name, Barabbas or whatever his name is, or Jesus, and the crowd chooses Jesus. And the history of manipulation, and you know it better than anybody because your writing is, to me, the most insightful writing about the history of manipulation that exists on the planet. And the history of manipulation is that if you're a member of the elite and you don't engage in the criminal behavior, the guy who does behave in the criminal behavior will get more money and buy the crowd, because the crowd can always be bought cheap, okay? And so you're in a gaming situation where you can't get sufficient control to enforce good behavior because the criminal can always buy the crowd out from under you. And so the history of the elites are a history of people who tried to do the right thing, usually getting killed. It's doing the right thing is always
I understand what you're saying, and this is an extremely deep question. Let me just mention that we're on here with Catherine Austin Fitz. This is John Rappaport, PRN, every week, Wednesdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. We are talking about the economy and, as you can tell, many more implications than money, but money is certainly there. Her website is www.solari.com. That's S-O-L-A-R-I. And if you've been listening, you certainly will go there to find out more. The deep question here to me is, does the crowd support the criminals naturally and automatically, or is it really that there is prior manipulation that has brought about that situation? In other words, it's very hard to put this metaphorically, to do the right kind of study on this, because you're always dealing, when you're dealing with crowds, with people that seem to have been previously manipulated. And then the manipulators come along and they say, guess what? We can't trust these idiots because
right.
Look what they do.
Right. No, the thing that makes the crowd sell out so cheap is usually a combination of force and propaganda.
Yes.
And, you know, the crowd responds to force and it responds to propaganda. And the goal of the force and propaganda over time is instead of getting somebody to sell out expensively, you're trying to get them to sell out cheap. That's the, you know, becomes the goal over time. And you know, there's no doubt in my mind that if, in theory, we could set up a sufficiently transparent system so that the force and the propaganda could always be seen and you could start to evolve to a much healthier system. You know, there's no doubt in my mind if and when we do that, you're going to get a much more responsible behaving crowd.
I agree with you. And also, to me, what's happening at a subconscious level in my study of manipulation is the prime manipulator is basically saying to himself on a subconscious level, I'm going to manipulate these people. After I've manipulated the crowd, and I see that they're untrustworthy because of my combination of propaganda and force, then I'm going to say, look at them. They can't be trusted. We have to control them. We have to depopulate them. We have to do all kinds of things to them. But really, at the bottom of all of this is simply that because I'm so cut off myself from life, the manipulator is saying to himself on a subconscious level, I don't trust anybody. So I'm going to cook up this scenario to rationalize my distrust and then bring it down and say, there's nothing else we can do except steal and engage in criminal behavior and control the mob.
As John Rappaport would say, it's a failure of imagination.
It's a failure of imagination, yes. And we're down to 1 minute here, so give me 30 seconds on the way out.
Well, if we can infuse the situation with enough imagination and find a way to re-inspire the heart of even people at the very top, you know, there is a way, because what is clearly obvious, John, is their theory on how to get from here to there is not working.
Exactly, and that's going to be the tagline because we've got to go here. This is John Rappaport. I've been talking with Catherine Austin Fitz in our second interview. You can be sure there will be more. Thank you so much, Catherine.
John, you're the best.
You are, and we'll see you next time. John Rappaport Show every week, Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern. See you next week.